As the year ends, twin spacecraft are being ready to settle into orbit around the moon over New Year's weekend. What will these probes tell us about Earth's only natural satellite? We'll talk to the mission's chief scientist. Plus, dispatches from the bottom of the Earth. We'll talk to researchers about science in the icy, windswept wilderness of Antarctica and the day-to-day challenges of studying everything from Adelie penguins to lava lakes and ice floes. And do you have a bad habit you'd like to kick in the new year? Coming up, we'll talk to a psychologist with tips on how to strengthen your willpower and make that New Year's resolution last. All coming up after the break. Stay with us. Do you disagree with something our guest said? Maybe something even I said? Or maybe you've got a suggestion for a future show? Well, now you can leave us a voicemail on the telephone. Here's that number, 724-374-3063. That's 724-374-3063. And we might just play it during a future show. But there's only one rule. You've got to keep it short. Under 60 seconds. The clock is ticking. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. That New Year's countdown has begun, not at the clock in Times Square, but this one for two NASA probes set to orbit the moon this weekend. The twin spacecraft, Grail A and Grail B, are expected to enter lunar orbit 24 hours apart, one on New Year's Eve, the other on New Year's Day. This marks the end of a 3.5-month journey for the washing machine-sized crafts launched from Florida in September. Just what does NASA scientists, what do they hope to do and accomplish? What are the pair of probes? What are they going to reveal about the Earth's closest neighbor 4 decades after man first landed on the moon? And how can twin spacecrafts chasing one another in circles help reveal the inner secrets of the moon? Why do we need two of them to do? Yeah, all interesting questions. All here, we're going to try to get them answered by Dr. Maria Zuber. She is principal investigator for NASA's GRAIL mission. Dr. Zuber is also a professor of geophysics, head of the Department of Earth, Atmospheric and Planetary Sciences at MIT. She's at WBUR in Boston. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Zuber.
Thank you, Ira. It's great to be back.
It's always good to have you. Tell us about the purpose. Why now, after all these years, do we send two of these probes to the moon?
Well, the various countries of the world have sent over 100 spacecraft to the moon. And there's still a lot of fundamental things that we don't understand about the moon. Most of these missions have studied the surface of the moon in various capacities, whether it be imaging craters and mountains or learning about composition, studying lunar samples. But fundamental things such as why the near side of the moon is different from the far side of the moon still aren't very well understood. And so it occurred to us that the answer might not be found on the surface. The answer might be inside of the moon. And that's what this mission proposes to study.
And what part of the inside of the moon are you trying to study?
From crust to core, we'll be producing a very precise map of the gravitational field of the moon. In fact, when we're finished with this mission, the gravity field of the moon will be known better than the gravitational field of the Earth. So it will be quite accurate.
And why do we need to do that? I mean, why specifically the gravitational field?
Gravity is one of the fundamental things that we try to study on the inside of a planet. Gravity studies the distribution of mass in the interior. So if we know something about what the composition is on the surface, if we know the size of the body, and if we know the mass, then we can understand what the what I'll call radial distribution of mass is in the interior. So we can learn about the crust, the mantle, and if the moon has a core, we will study that as well.
You do say that the moon is a mysterious place, that the side facing us is different than the side further on the other side. It's also mysterious because we're not quite sure how the moon was created, are we?
Well, I will say the only theory for the formation of the moon that doesn't have a fatal flaw is one where the moon was formed due to the impact of a Mars-sized body into the Earth. This impactor hit the Earth at a relatively high angle And the core of this impactor is thought to have wrapped itself around the core of the Earth, and parts of the crust and mantle of the impactor and the Earth were thrown off into orbit and were thought to have formed the moon, or perhaps even more than one moon, as a recent theory has suggested.
And will these studies with these twin satellites, satellites of the moon, will they tell us any more about that process?
Well, it's certainly hoped that that would be the case. The recent study suggesting that the Earth may have, in fact, had more than one moon back in time after this gigantic collision took place came out relatively recently. It came out this spring in a paper in Nature, and it wasn't something that we had conceived of when we had written the proposal to do the GRAIL mission. But the idea shows some plausibility, did some calculations to demonstrate plausibility, and it laid out specific ideas that can be tested by understanding things about the inside of the moon. So the idea behind this second moon theory is that a moon about a third of the size of our current moon was in the same orbit around Earth as our moon was. And because it was in the same orbital plane, it wasn't moving very fast in comparison to our moon. And so it was stable for some period of time, but eventually it became unstable and drifted towards our moon and impacted it. But because it was moving at about the same, very close to the same velocity of our moon, it behaved very differently than normal collisions that we have on planets. Normally, when we have a collision on a planet, what happens is a great deal of kinetic energy gets thrown into the planet and a big hole gets excavated, which forms an impact crater or an impact basin. And if you look at the surface of the moon, Mercury, any of the solid planets, you will see a heavily cratered surface. Well, because of the fact that this collision of the Earth's or the moon's purported companion was at a very low velocity, it actually adds more material to the moon than it excavates. So instead of forming a hole on the moon, it formed a mountain. And one of the puzzling things about the backside of the moon is that there is a huge highland area in the equatorial region of the moon, which does not occur on the moon's front side. There have been a lot of ideas about what this mountain might have been due to, what would produce a mountain on one side of a planet and not another. And one of the ideas is that it could be the remnants of this collision of an early moon.
Fascinating. Would some pieces have drifted away, or would they all still be on the moon, the remnants of that second moon?
Certainly, I think some parts of the moon would have in the collision are lost from the moon, but the bulk of it, the preponderance of the material, actually sticks with the moon and adds to its mass. It's a very
it's fascinating,
a remarkably creative idea. and actually, the simulations that were shown demonstrated that that it's plausible. I mean, it doesn't prove that it was the case, but it lays out some things that one can look for in the inside of the moon to test whether or not this was the case.
So your twin grails, A and B, can help solve that problem?
They certainly can. They will provide information that will allow us to evaluate that hypothesis. So we can either at that point reject it, or it may need to be modified on the basis of what we find, or demonstrate that it was correct.
Well, it's a sort of serendipitous that you designed this way before that whole hypothesis came up.
That's correct. We had plenty of other interesting things that we wanted to look at, but it's remarkable that having studied the moon for so long, that there are still great new ideas about the moon and the Earth-Moon system. I mean, the Earth is. The Earth is involved in this this whole process of what was going on back then.
Wow. And I understand that even though you've dubbed these satellites Grail A and Grail B, their names are going to change.
The names are going to change soon. So,
do we know what they are yet?
I know what they are.
Just tell me, okay?
you and all the many listeners of Science Friday, you will all learn soon enough. After the successful launch of the two spacecraft in September, we announced that there would be a naming contest, and we permitted schools and other student organizations to propose names for the spacecraft. And they needed, when they proposed these, they had to write an essay with the idea that the names should in some way reflect something about the mission, something about the moon, something about the fact that the students realize that there are two spacecraft operating in a certain way. And so a group of us evaluated those names. And after the two spacecraft are successfully in orbit, we'll announce the winners.
There's also a moon cam, right? Kids can look at the moon from spacecraft?
Yes. In terms of the scientific payload, it's two spacecraft with the same instrument on each spacecraft, because the spacecraft make their measurement by ranging to each other. But what we decided to do is put cameras on the spacecraft, but not to give them a scientific purpose. The experiment is called MoonCam, and it's being run by Sally Ride, America's first woman in space. And each spacecraft has four cameras on it, which are pointed at different. Two are looking at Nadir, which is directly below. One looks a little bit in front of, and one looks a little bit below. And these cameras have no scientific purpose. The purpose of them is totally education and outreach. And students and schools can sign up to be a part of the MoonCam project. It's targeted for middle schoolers. And students will need, in collaboration with their teachers, learn how to use the software. I imagine it'll be the students teaching the teachers how to use this software in a lot of cases. That's the way it often works, where they can – schools will be assigned a period of time, and they will study the trajectory of the spacecraft and what parts of the moon they'll be passing over and propose to take images. That'll be operated out of the University of California, San Diego, by Sally Ride Science.
And it sounds very exciting. There's a lot of stuff going on up there. Dr. Zuber, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us and making this educational opportunity available.
Yeah, thank you very much, Ira.
You're welcome. Dr. Maria Zuber is principal investigator for NASA's GRAIL mission, and she is also professor of geophysics and the head of the Department of Earth, Atmospheric and Planetary Sciences at MIT. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to make a phone call, take a phone call from Antarctica. Yeah, live from Antarctica. We'll talk about research. You know, it's summertime down there. It's just beginning to heat up with the research. So we'll talk about what's going on down there. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Hi, Ira Flatow here, wishing you only the best in this holiday season and hoping you might think about putting Science Friday on your gift list. You can make a tax-deductible donation. Any amount will do. Please just go to our website at sciencefriday.com and click on the Support Science Friday button at the top. Thanks and happy holidays. You're listening to Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. It may be winter up north, but down in Antarctica, the summer fun has just begun. Fun, of course, if you're a scientist or an explorer. What could be more exciting than studying endless, beautiful blue ice, unique plant and animal life, the ebb and flow of towering glaciers? And so each year, thousands of researchers converge on the frozen continent, with summer research season that kicks off in November. A summer, of course, in Antarctica is not like one in most places. It's got a few challenges. You have to not mind sleeping in tents with 75-mile-per-hour winds, or snowmobiling across ice with dangerous crevasses there, or looking into the mouth of a steaming volcano. Yeah, Antarctic and South Pole exploration is also celebrating its 100th 100-year anniversary, because 100 years ago this minute, two exploration parties were racing to the South Pole. I'm talking about the Amundsen and Scott expeditions. Joining us to talk about science and the southernmost point of the Earth are a couple of researchers and a photojournalist who has spent some time in Antarctica. And let me introduce Kayla Iacovino. She's also a PhD student at Cambridge. She's studying volcanology and petrology and has been sharing her experiences at Mount Erebus right there in Antarctica on her blog. She was here, you might remember, a year ago. She was on our show at sciencefriday.com. Welcome back.
Hi, Ira. Good to be back.
Good to have you back. Chris Lindner is the author of Science on Ice, Four Polar Expeditions. Chris Lindner is teamed up with four science writers to create a really richly illustrated book that's loaded with gorgeous photographs, which looks at how science gets done at the poles. And Chris joins us from Seattle. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks a lot, Ira. It's great to be here.
We're trying to get in touch with Tanuka Ilanko, and she's a PhD student at the University of Cambridge in the UK. She is in Antarctica and near Mount Erebus in a phone booth. We're trying to get through to her, but you know how technology works, sending a long-distance call. We'll keep putting quarters into the phone and see if we can get through. But let me begin with you, Kayla. Tell us about what's going on in Antarctica compared to what you were doing last year.
Well, some of the same studies are continuing this year. A lot of the volcanic monitoring that I was a part of my group is still happening. So on Mount Erebus there, just so your listeners have a bit of background, Mount Erebus is a very active volcano located right near McMurdo Station, which is the largest Antarctic base. It's an American base. And they give us basically support and then send everything and all our supplies and helicopter us up to the volcano where we live for about a month and monitor all kinds of things, like look at the volcanic gases that are coming out of the volcano, looking at the thermal properties of the lava lake, which is in the volcano. There's also people studying the ice caves, which are on Mount Erebus. And they're formed when the hot volcanic gases from Erebus move through the ice on top of the volcano and carve out these beautiful caverns with some gorgeous crystals, ice crystals in them. And there's also people looking at infrasound and seismic to study the inner workings of the volcano as well.
Mm-hmm. Chris Lindner, of course, you were there yourself taking pictures at McMurdo there.
That's right.
And the gorgeous ice caves. There's a great picture in your book of, is it you? I can't remember. Someone with a laptop inside an ice cave.
That was my writer, Hugh Powell, and that was actually taken during what's called happy camper training, which everyone who goes into the field in Antarctica has to go through. And it's basically an introduction in how not to die in Antarctica. And so we were reporting for the entire time we were in Antarctica doing daily dispatches posted to a website. And we said, well, we would love to continue doing the reporting during happy camper training. And so we brought our gear along, and for that night that we spent in what's called a Quinsy, a little ice cave, we typed out and sent a dispatch.
Wow. I know things are a lot different these days, Kayla. There's actually a landline that we're trying to get through to. When I was there many years ago, there was only a shortwave radio, and you were lucky to get through on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're actually surprisingly well-connected at McMurdo and even at Erebus, which is considered a remote camp. I mean, we had Wi-Fi up there. The Wi-Fi was coming from our hut, and we sleep in tents outside of the hut. I could actually be on the internet on my iPhone in my tent when I was there. So, I mean, we do have a lot of really good connectivity up there. It's not as remote as you would think.
Last time when you were talking to us from Mount Erebus and looking down into the mouth of the volcano, a year later, have you noticed, are there any changes from what you saw?
Oh, definitely. I've been, as you know, I'm in the States right now. I'm not down in the field. But I've been correlating all the reports coming in from there and posting them on the blog. And it looks like the lava lake has dropped a couple of meters in height, and it's also become a bit smaller, so it might have crusted over a bit. And the weather has been completely different there this year. It's a lot wetter, and so the plume, the gases coming out of the volcano, become thicker and obscure the lava lake. So they haven't actually had that many good views into the lake. We had a really good year last year and got some really amazing shots.
Now, National Science Foundation funds a lot of research that goes on in Antarctica, and they send them all down on these big airplanes. Chris, what was your experience like on one of those planes?
Yeah, it's a pretty incredible opportunity to be able to travel on this huge Air Force plane. What's funny is when you load up in Christchurch, New Zealand, that's where you leave. It's summer, so it's 85 degrees. There's cicadas humming, and you got the smell of flowers. And early in the morning, it's not even light yet. You get into this belly of this aircraft wearing a humongous red parka, these ridiculous looking white boots, wind pants, and so you're just sweating freely as you get into this aircraft. And you never know what's going to be inside when you get in. There could be an 8-foot-wide drill running down the middle of the aircraft, or four vehicles, or a whole row of seats. Then you get in there, and you're kind of whisked up into the air, and it's usually a 5-hour trip. And it's kind of disorienting because there's only about, you know, one or two little portholes that you can peek through to see this beautiful environment unfolding underneath you. And when you land on the sea ice outside of McMurdo Station and step out, and all of a sudden you've gone from summer in New Zealand to summer in Antarctica, which is a very different thing. There's no smells at all. You get hit with this dry, kind of chilling wind when you're out on the runway, maybe 15 degrees Fahrenheit, maybe colder out there. And you've realized that the thing you need most is sunscreen and sunglasses, because it's usually this bright sun is just beaming at you.
Mm-hmm. It's also, you described McMurdo as this big, sprawling, what looks like a mining colony.
Yeah, it's when you get there, you realize just how much research is going on down there during the summer months. The thing that I will never forget is this beeping sound of these loaders. Whenever they're backing up, of course, they're making a beeping sound, just like any truck in the United States. These vehicles are constantly on the move, carrying equipment, food to the helicopter pad, back up to these one of the 47 buildings that comprise McMurdo Station. And so it's designed to kind of get researchers their safety courses and to get them their gear and get them out in the field so they can get to do science as soon as possible. But it's a lot of work.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're now going to see if we can bring in somebody live from Antarctica. She's a PhD student at the University of Cambridge in the UK. Tanuka Ilanko, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Tell us what you're studying there. What's your day like in Antarctica?
Well, I'm studying gases coming out of the plume in the lava lake of Mount Erebus. Basically, I've got an instrument up at the crater rim, and it measures the infrared radiation. That's basically heat that's coming out of the lake. But since the heat is passing through the gases, some of it gets absorbed, and by looking at the spectrum of energy that's remaining and modelling what's been absorbed, we can figure out what gases are present and in what quantities.
And why is it so important for you to study Mount Erebus? It is one of the few active volcanoes on the Earth, is it not?
Yeah, it's one of only three with a long-lived active lava lake, which basically represents a window into a convecting magmatic system. So that's quite an unusual opportunity. And surprisingly enough, Antarctica is one of the best places to study this, because the other two are in Ethiopia and in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Mount Erebus is the most accessible.
And not only that, you have a lot more sunlight during the day to do your work.
We do. We've got 24 hours of daylight.
Yeah. And does that represent a challenge to sleeping or running the rest of your life, all that daylight?
It does. Some people find it very difficult to sleep. Some people find it very difficult to stop working. So by the end of the season, we're all on quite unusual schedules.
And how will you measure your success over there?
Well, it's good to have everything up and running.
Mm-hmm.
There are a bunch of different projects going on, so as long as we're getting in good data that we can process, then that's an achievement for us. At the moment, we're working on trying to get some instruments running over the winter, which would be a really big achievement. We'd get, instead of just 1 month of data, we'd be getting 12 months.
So you think it could stay by itself and run in the dark, the 6 months of darkness there in that cold?
So the idea would be that everything would be automated. We would have a wireless link that sends everything back to McMurdo, and we'd be able to operate the instruments remotely. Well, so no one would actually have to be up here.
Well, I know it's difficult for you to talk to us, but I want to wish you good luck and with your research, and thank you for taking time to be with us, and Happy New Year to you.
Thank you. The same to you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. Tanuka Ilanko is a PhD student at the University of Cambridge in the UK. She's studying volcanology and gas geochemistry, and currently she's right there at the base of Mount Erebus. Kayla Iacovino, could you tell us where she was speaking from? Was it a phone booth? Where do you have a phone booth at the bottom of a mountain in Antarctica?
Well, if we do have a landline up there, I believe there's one that's connected through that adjacent New Zealand base there. Mm-hmm. And there might be also a landline that goes back to McMurdo. So, or it's possible, of course, she was doing what I was doing last year, which was using the satellite phone, although that's not as reliable of a connection.
Yeah, we're very lucky to get it. Chris Linder is author of Science on Ice, Four Polar Expeditions. You only talked about one expedition to Antarctica, but you had other polar expeditions, and I was very intrigued by your Greenland experience, and you're talking about these huge ice melt lakes that exist in Greenland.
Yeah, that was probably my second favorite place on Earth after the Cape Crozier penguin colony down in Antarctica, because it's just such a unique environment. You've got meltwater that's forming on the Greenland ice sheet and collecting into these depressions on the ice to form these turquoise blue jewels, basically, is what they look like from the air, from the helicopter. And the researchers there are interested in what happens to that water in these lakes when it suddenly disappears. What they were noticing from the satellite record is that one day there will be a lake there 4 kilometers long, you know, containing millions of gallons of water, and the next day it'd be totally gone. And so they were putting instruments around the lakes to try to determine when that water disappears, you know, through cracks in the bottom, just like pulling the plug in a bathtub. What does it do to the ice?
Wow. So all that is going down below the ice and lubricating the ice, possibly, and letting its glacier slide?
Yeah, that's what they found out by using these very precise GPS recorders placed around the lake. They could tell exactly how that ice sheet was responding, mm-hmm. and just like grease on a railroad track, it makes that ice sheet slip a little bit faster when that lake actually drains and goes through 1,000 meters of ice all the way to the bottom.
Talking about Antarctic research this hour on Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Chris Linder and Kayla Iacovino on number 1-800-989-8255. Kayla, what do you miss about not being down there this season?
Oh, God, there's so much. There's so much I miss. I'm really hoping I can go back next season. I think Antarctica is the most beautiful place in the world. It had some of the most incredible landforms and ice forms that I've ever seen. And yeah. Really, I mean, even working... You know, I miss the people as well. Working there in a group, we were 12 of us for a month in a remote hut where we didn't really see anyone else except for maybe the occasional helicopter pilot if they came in for a coffee or something. And so you kind of get to be a pretty tight-knit group, and it's a really unique environment to work in. And, I mean, there's so many amazing things about it. Exploring the ice caves, going up to the crater rim and watching explosions, it's just amazing.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's get a phone call or two if we can. Let's go to Leslie. And is it Rollins, Wyoming?
Yes, it is.
Hi there. Welcome.
I just wanted to say how wonderful it is to hear some scientists live from Antarctica. Last winter, I had the most amazing experience. I accompanied a team of researchers from the University of Washington down to Antarctica with a program called Polar Trek. And the point of this organization, which is funded by the National Science Foundation, is to embed teachers with research teams to help bring science back to students around the world and get them intrigued in the science that's going on and hopefully entice them to go into different science fields to get out of school. And I was located in 3 different remote camps along the Beardmore Glacier in the Trans-Antarctic Mountains. This was exciting for me, not only with the type of science we were doing and seeing how science is conducted out in the field, but the Beardmore Glacier was also very historically important because this was the route that Scott took in his quest to be the first to reach the South Pole, actually 100 years ago.
Yeah.
So this was a really exciting experience for me, and I just wanted to share that.
Thank you very much, Leslie. Yeah, it's a life-changing experience, is it not?
Definitely so. I'm still trying to figure out a way that I can get back down there.
Yeah, well, you're not going to get to the same spot, but, you know, there are cruise ships and everything that go to the peninsula from South America, so maybe you can get closer. Whoop, well, I just lost her. It does change your life, Kayla, does it not?
Oh, definitely, definitely. It's interesting you're talking about the cruise ships. There was one or two that came through McMurdo while we were there, and when we first arrived, they were giving us a tour of some of the laboratory spaces and telling us about when these cruise ships would come through, and they kind of take them on tours through McMurdo and almost are, and here are some scientists in their natural environment. It almost felt like being, you know, in a zoo or something.
Right.
It was really funny.
Next up, penguins.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take I can't believe a cruise ship actually has gotten this far as McMurdo. Things have changed a bit since I was there.
Yeah.
1-800-989-8255. We're going to take a break and talk more with Chris Linder, author of Science on Ice, Four Polar Expeditions, and Kayla Iacovino. She's a PhD student at Cambridge. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. We'll be right back after this break. Science is now sexy. Science has become the theme of TV shows and Broadway plays, film and artwork. And we think it's a real trend, and we've created a whole science and arts section right on our website, entertaining interviews with artists and actors, scientists and celebrities. It's the only one of its kind, and I invite you to check it out at sciencefriday.com/arts. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about the challenges scientists face while studying everything from volcanoes to ice caves in Antarctica with my guests, Kayla Iacovino, a PhD student at the University of Cambridge in the UK, Chris Linder, author of Science on Ice, Four Polar Expeditions, our number 1-800-989-8255. We were talking about polar explorers, and this being the 100th anniversary of Scott Amundsen racing to the South Pole. Chris, it's hard when you're down there to avoid the fact that you're in a very old place. It's almost like a living museum with the shacks there sort of frozen in time, and yet all this new research is going on.
It is, and in some cases, those buildings are side by side. At McMurdo Station, Scott's Discovery Hut is within sight of McMurdo Station, the modern U.S. station there. And if you go out to Cape Royds, which is out on the sea ice, you know, just a short snowmobile ride away from McMurdo, there's Shackleton's Hut, built in 1908, sitting, you know, probably a quarter mile away from the Penguin Researcher's Hut, which is there now. And so the, you know, history is all around you when you're down there, and those monuments are lovingly restored by the New Zealanders who take care of them. And walking in there, you see pictures on the walls that Shackleton and his party brought down there, boots stuffed with straw. Everything looks like they just got up from a meal and walked out and never came back.
And it's interesting because I was reading in your book about finding a penguin that had been on the table open for dissection. And I swear that must be the same penguin I saw 30 years ago, still on that table.
Yeah, you'll see, you know, seals stacked outside that they had used for food for their dogs. All these things are monuments, and because of the Antarctic Treaty, nothing is to be touched or removed. And so, you know, as you're walking around a penguin colony like Cape Royds, you'll actually see little pieces of wood that have been broken off by the wind from the dog kennels or other things that Shackleton built. And those are historic debris, and they're not to be touched or picked up or altered in any way.
You know, we talk about the research that's going on there, but there's a lot of astronomy research going on there, too, in Antarctica, isn't there? And stuff you don't hear very much about. The sun, because they have 6 months of sunlight, you can, you know, look at the sun. I think even in that neutrino experiment that we're talking about, wasn't it going through the Earth and coming out in Antarctica someplace?
Right. I think that was being built at South Pole Station.
Yeah.
So, you know, another flight away to the south.
And that is one of the most coveted trips, is it not, to the South Pole? Because very few scientists, even though they may spend decades there, ever get to go to the South Pole.
Yeah, and I haven't been there myself, but I'd love to go.
Yeah. Kayla, do they talk about that a lot?
Oh, definitely. That's one of the – a couple of the hot spots is if you're in McMurdo, it's going to Erebus, and everywhere else it's going to the South Pole.
So I actually count myself among the very lucky to have been there all those years ago, and I remember scientists being very jealous of me.
Did you make it to the pole?
Got it to the pole. Pictures. It was, of course, there was a different pole station there. When I was there in 1979, they had just built a new pole station. That is already gone and is a brand spanking new one there. But it is a place, and it's really interesting that you talk, both of you, and I'm sure you can both testify to this, Chris, you talk about how unforgiving the weather is down there. If you make a mistake, you've had it.
Yeah, it can change rapidly. And even a year ago, I was coming off of the Nathaniel B. Palmer and Icebreaker in about mid-February, and we were among the last in McMurdo that were getting ready to leave. And after we left, I had seen these news reports that a Norwegian party had come down kind of unannounced, and they were going to take some four-wheelers down to the South Pole without permission from anybody. Their ship, a storm brewed up, came out of the south with a terrific windstorm. Sank their ship, I think killed two of them on board, and a couple of them had to be rescued and brought back to New Zealand by the U.S. Staff that was remaining down there. So even though, our ability to handle the environment has gotten a lot better, it still is not a place to be toyed with.
And that's why you have so much respect for those polar explorers of 100 years ago. They had hardly any of the modern clothing and technology that we had. And some of them spent years down there at a time.
Yeah, and did even more epic things than we're doing now, like the trek that one of the parties made in the middle of winter to go get an emperor penguin egg at Cape Crozier, braving, 70 degree below zero temperatures, trekking along in boots filled with straw and, sleeping bags that would freeze overnight from their sweat, and they'd have to, press their feet into them to warm them up.
Hmm. Kayla, are you going back anytime soon?
I hope so. I have my fingers crossed to get down there next season.
And still studying Mount Erebus?
Yep. Going to be taking more samples and taking more measurements.
Mm-hmm. And what exactly, fascinates you about this?
Oh, there's so many aspects to it. I mean, just my volcanological, interest in it is purely that, but also just the fact that it's this volcano in Antarctica, it's this whole fire and ice thing right. going on. And it's just, like I said, it's just a beautiful place. And Erebus is a really unique volcano. It's got some really interesting magmas that come out of it. I'm interested in the chemistry of the magma, so that's a big thing for me. And also just the active lava lake. I mean, going to an active volcano is an amazing thing as it is, but to go to one that you can actually see the inside of it at the surface is pretty incredible.
Let's see if we can get a phone call or two in here. Matt in Cincinnati. Hi, Matt.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Great show.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Hey, I had a question. It seems to me last year about this time there was you had a story about, I believe it was some Russians drilling through about 2 miles of ice on top of a lake down there. I was wondering whatever became of that.
Chris, any idea what happened?
I think from what I heard, they got close and then had to abort at the last minute because they had run out of time. But that was a big deal because no one had ever broken through into that lake before.
Because there's a lot of ice to drill through, isn't there?
Yeah, I can't remember how thick it was, but it took all season to get as far as they did.
And the drill goes very slowly. The ice is very tough, and you run out of time, right? Because you're not staying out there in the middle of the darkness.
Weren't there some contamination issues as well?
Yeah, that was a huge concern because there's all these chemical lubricants that are used to keep the drill from freezing, and once you tap into previously untapped environment, it's going to be forever changed. It'll never be the exact same as when it before you drilled into it.
With all that sunlight down there, I remember asking this over 30 years ago, the people, why don't you have solar energy, that kind of stuff, to tap into generation? Is there any more thought to that going on? Or even the field stations?
They're doing more of that now.
Yeah.
I know at Erebus, we have wind and solar power, but we have a backup generator as well. just in case.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Norman in Monroe, North Carolina. Hi, Norman.
Good afternoon, folks. I'm listening on the station WFAE in Charlotte. I have two questions, and it's kind of a strange one. First, how do you keep your potable water from freezing? And second, when you have a call from nature, how do you handle it in subarctic temperatures?
That is so funny. That is, I have to say, that is probably the number one question I get asked is, how do you pee?
Yeah.
And especially if we're living in a tent and you need to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night, obviously you don't want to have to get up and put on all your gear, you know, long underwear, wind pants, parka, gloves, hat, everything, because that would just take too long. You'd, you know, pee your pants before you got outside. So what we do is the United States Antarctic Program issues their very own pee bottles, which is basically a wide mouth Nalgene bottle. And you learned very quickly how to hover above your sleeping bag, men and women, how to hover above your sleeping bag and pee into a bottle in your tent at night.
Well, I hate to end the program on that, though. But it is part of the experience, right? I remember being here.
Yeah.
It's all part of that experience. And I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us today. And have a happy New Year.
Thank you so much. Yeah, you too.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Ira.
You're welcome. Kayla Iacovino is a PhD student at the University of Cambridge in the UK. Chris Linder is author of Science on Ice, Four Polar Expeditions. If you'd like to see some stunning pictures of Antarctica, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We have a few up there, but the book itself is worth a buy. Next up, say it's time for New Year's resolutions. You want to lose your weight or you want to quit smoking. You don't know how to make your New Year's resolution last more than, well, let's say a week. Some researchers say the answer may lie in strengthening your willpower. And my next guest is one of them. Dr. Roy Baumeister is co-author of the book Willpower: Rediscovering the Greatest Human Strength. He's professor of psychology at Florida State University, and he joins us from Tallahassee. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thank you, Ira. I'm glad to be here.
What do we have to do to get willpower?
What do we have to do? Well, everybody has some. It's you just got to manage what you have. You have to understand how it works, that you have a limited amount of it, that it waxes and wanes as you use it. And in ideal circumstances, you can build it up like a muscle by exercising it steadily over time.
You mean you purposely put yourself in a situation where you need some willpower to overcome it, so you practice it?
Yes, you can do things. You start by making small changes in your life. In one of the studies we did, we just had people work on their posture for a couple weeks. And that then produced changes on all sorts of things that had nothing to do with posture, because you just get used to correcting your own behavior and bringing it up to your goals and standards. Some other work has found that people who do these little exercises, you know, you can switch, use your left hand for things you normally use your right hand for, and so on. If you do these over time, they can make you better able to succeed at quitting smoking and controlling alcohol and other things like that. Willpower, there's one resource that you have, and you use it for anything. So if you build it up in exercising one thing, it helps with the next thing.
Does changing your diet help you at all?
Well, willpower is energy. It's real energy. It's tied into the body's food supply. So what you eat is the source of your food, which is why dieting is one of the most difficult things to exert self-control in, because you need to eat in order to have the willpower to resist eating. But in terms of changing your diet, well, there's a nutritionist literature. I mean, in the laboratory, when we want to give people a boost of willpower, ironically, we give them sugar, but that's just because in the laboratory, we only have people for a short time, and we need something that works fast. We recommend eating protein and other sort of healthy foods that your body can burn over a longer period of time to get energy from. That's probably the best advice in terms of diet.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Roy Baumeister, co-author of the book Willpower: Rediscovering the Greatest Human Strength. Should we be taking on New Year's resolutions that, you know, we have the willpower to do them? I mean, sometimes we might bite off more than we can chew,
well,
going overboard.
That's an important point. I remember you only have one stack of willpower, and every time you try to change yourself, you're using some of that. So when you make a bunch of resolutions all at once, each one you try to do is detracting from your ability to do all the others. So, you know, it's a good idea. I totally believe in making oneself a better person and so on. But do the things one at a time rather than all at once.
So you're saying we basically have a storage house of willpower that we can deplete.
Yes, absolutely. We use the term depletion very much in our research. It's become more and more used among the research community, called ego depletion tied into the self. But, you know, we can think of it in ordinary terms as depletion of willpower. Hmm. And, yes, that happens to people every day in ways that can be measured and objective differences and how likely you are to give in to a temptation later in the day after you've used up your willpower as opposed to earlier in the day when your stock is more there. So, yes, very much. It's important to understand how willpower works, which is why we wrote the book you so kindly mentioned. Use it once. I mean, that's why the different New Year's resolutions will work against each other. But if you do them
too many
in series, completing the first one will actually strengthen your ability to move on to the second one.
So if you want to lose weight, as that's your New Year's resolution, you can gain more willpower by challenging yourself with the food you want to avoid. Would that be correct? In other words, if you want to strengthen your willpower, add to your reserve, and you see a brownie sitting there, you put the brownie down and say, I'm not going to eat that.
Well, as long as you succeed at not eating. there seems to be some risk involved in that strategy. If you give in, then that sets you back. I would say if losing weight is difficult, and that's the most challenging thing, don't make that the first thing you do. Set a more realistic goal to make your bed every day, or stop swearing in front of the children, or I don't know what. And then when you've made those changes and those are successful, then you can move on perhaps to a more challenging one. Also, we, like most of the research assessment, dieting itself, going on a severe crash diet is not a good strategy. People lose weight and then gain it right back. What you really want to do is gradually make permanent changes in how you eat, so that you can you can live in a long-term way with this food and still get the nutrition you need and still get the enjoyment out of eating, which is
so take a little get little willpower victories and they'll add up so you can tackle the big one is what you're
absolutely
saying.
Absolutely, I think that's a great way to put it, Ira. That's what people should do, and much better than making five resolutions, trying to do them all at once, and then getting nowhere with any of them.
Well, thank you for those tips.
All right.
Roy Baumeister is the co-author of the book Willpower, Rediscovering the Greatest Human Strength. He's also professor of psychology at Florida State University in Tallahassee. Thank you for joining us and have a happy new year. For you iOS fans, just go to the iTunes Store and search for the Sci-Fry BE app. That's the Sci-Fry BE app. Download and enjoy. Our program senior producer is Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Intaglietta, Namisha Saran Anand, and Alessia Baya. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Neil Rausch is our technical director at the controls here in New York.